Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868. 221-5868. MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Summer takes flight at Turtle Bay's Wings of Summer Butterfly Exhibit, open June 19th through August 15th. Experience hundreds of butterflies in a tranquil and enclosed garden. Access is free for Turtle Bay members and included with park admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Join us for Turtle Bay's Walk on the Wild Side Animal Show, running Tuesday to Sunday at 11 a.m. and noon. This fun-filled educational wildlife show gives you a special look at Turtle Bay's most beloved animals. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Your friendly oil change, Premier in all we do.
Summer is upon us, and we all know what that means. Lots of summertime fun. Spin at the lake, by the pool, or off on adventures to your favorite waterfall or floating down the river. Servicing your vehicle is last on the list, but we all know it has to be done. Let Premier Oil Change save you time and money with their easy drive-in service. No appointment needed. Wait in the comfort of your own car, enjoy a cold beverage, and before you know it, you'll be off to your next summertime adventure, knowing that your car is summertime ready. Earn reward points for every dollar you spend, which can be redeemed for an oil change, additional services, and other great rewards. With free fluid top-offs, free check engine light inspections, free Wi-Fi, and a free car wash, you are sure to leave refreshed. Stop into a Premier Oil Change near you today. Visit them in Palisadro in the Holiday Shopping Center or in Redding on Lake Boulevard near Waterworks Park. And don't forget Anderson across from Round Table Pizza. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The View, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes. J.R.R. Tolkien.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our monster of the day. These can really be true monsters. It's the Fae. Those tricky buggers.
We're talking not only fairies, but elves, pixies, sometimes gnomes are considered fae. There are a lot of creatures that are vaguely humanoid with a little bit of a magical twist and often have a very druidic nature in their style of magic. So we are calling them as a super category fae.
With the fae usually comes an almost human appearance. They have the same general shape. They're a humanoid. But there's something different. There's something magical, mystical about them.
A lot of times they're the people who wield the plant-type magic. So if you go into a fae kind of realm, they have their own homelands in a way. And they have interesting light. They are associated with interesting kinds of lighting styles and plants-based architecture. Bridges that are made out of vines and life in the trees and that kind of thing. Most of our monsters are going to be either animalistic or way above humans or a dumb version of humans. The fae tend to be almost equivalent, if not for their longevity. And therefore they're able to be a little wiser in a lot of respects.
But the definition and the traditions of what fae are have changed and developed so much over the years. So in the 16th century, you had a philosopher, alchemist, toxicologist named Paracelsus who classified elves and gnomes as spirits of the air. And that's definitely not what we picture today when we think of elves and gnomes.
I think, like our opener quote kind of implied, Tolkien has redefined what elves are for us. Until Tolkien, almost everybody thought of elves as being anywhere between child size to the size of your fist.
Tinkerbell size.
Yeah.
But now we picture elves as tall, elegant, graceful, walking beings because Tolkien redefined the word.
And I think a lot of the references that I hear to elves in my personal life end up coming through Dungeons and Dragons. They have a very Tolkien style of elf, although I do believe in the version I play, they're slightly shorter than humans.
It depends on the kind of elf. Going back to EverQuest, which was the first, like, digital version of D&D, this is where I got my definitions of elves. You had the high elves, which were very Tolkien-esque, tall, elegant elves. You had wood elves that were the shorter, more druidic-based elves. And then night elves, which are in D&D drow.
And if you wanted to listen to another episode talking about the character of elves, we did kind of mention this style in our Shoulder Angels episode, which was back in February, where we talked about the id, ego, super ego. A lot of this super ego stuff gets applied to elves. And that's why I am including Vulcans in the elf, mostly in just modern mythology.
They're space elves.
They play basically the same role in the story.
You go back in history, and elves are more like Santa's elves. Small creatures there to help, or Harry Potter's house elves, where they're helpers, they're servants in some kind of way. But elves aren't the only fae out there.
Probably my favorite are the Tinkerbell pixie type elves in the movie Willow. They were called brownies. The little guys that just kind of make mischief. They'll move stuff around and they'll maybe cast little bits of magic here and there and they can disappear and reappear. They apparently have a huge hankering for cream. They like get drunk off of fresh cream.
So you have your fairies, pixies, brownies. These are very Celtic in origin. There's a lot of those associations where you can throw out a handful of salt and they have to count every single bit of salt that fell.
That's how you catch a pixie, if you're curious.
Yeah.
And if you want more research on that, there's a fantastic Supernatural episode. It's great.
Fight the fairies! So you also have things like gnomes. Our definition of gnomes in the nerd world are different than the definition of gnomes in a lot of the normal world, because you have gnomes as in, like, World of Warcraft D&D gnomes, and then you have garden gnomes. They're very different.
But gnomes tend to be even smaller than normally a childlike house elf, and that's, I think, size is a big difference between gnomes and dwarves. But they enjoy the non-living parts of the earth, mostly gems and that kind of thing.
In a lot of, like, D&D type culture, they are associated with the tinkerers. They're the steampunk characters that are creating the mechanical what's-its that might just explode.
One of my fondest images of elves and the fae in general actually comes from Shakespeare. If you've ever seen A Midsummer Night's Dream, basically they get lost in the woods and this fairy queen comes and takes them on this adventure that they go on. And it's all very mystical and magical and everyone portrays it slightly different, which is one of my favorite things about Shakespeare, is you'll never see the same Shakespeare twice.
You also have a lot of fae represented in Arthurian traditions. Prince Arthur and the fairy queen. If you've seen the recent Netflix show Cursed, it's a different representation of the fae and magical beings with King Arthur before he was King Arthur.
And I think Witcher had some references to elves in a way that is not commonly seen nowadays. They weren't the tall, elegant, must-be-respected kind of characters. So that was an interesting look at those characters.
Most of the ones we've been talking about are usually benign. Sometimes tricksters, sometimes out just to have a little bit of fun. But then you have some that are just straight up evil.
The red cap is basically an evil version of the gnome. They can be tamed, but mostly just by evil people, into becoming something between an ally and a pet.
One of the ones you may think of first would be the changelings. This was seen in the show and book series Outlander. The idea that these beings will switch out an infant child with a changeling child, and they'll kill the human child and force the humans to raise the changeling child so that they don't have to do it.
And in order to deal with the changeling, if it happens soon enough, they might be willing to, like, trade the child back if you manage to figure out that it's not your kid before they kill your actual kid.
You also have Will-o'-the-Wisps, and these are represented very differently in a lot of different media. So you have Brave, where the Will-o'-the-Wisps are treated more like light beings that are just leading her toward her destiny. But in a lot of classic traditions, if you followed the Will-o'-the-Wisp, you would die.
They often hung out around bogs and swamps. So if you followed this light, you would end up stuck in this bog and you would die there.
Historical basis for this: what actually was happening were gases from the swamp or bog lighting on fire, and it would just kind of flash and people would follow it and fall into the swamp. Like, that's what actually was happening. One of the biggest questions with the Fae is, how do you deal with them?
We mentioned earlier throwing salt on the ground will stall them, so they have to stand there and count every single one.
A lot of the classic interpretations make Fae really vulnerable to iron. Like, it'll burn their skin if they touch it.
But mostly, I think the best way to deal with them is to just don't deal with them.
Avoid them and never make a deal with a fairy.
Absolutely. That's where a bit of the trickster magic comes in, which is very indicative of the fairies and the pixies.
So if you are interested in writing fairies, writing the Fae into your story, remember that you aren't limited to what you've seen before. These traditions have changed and developed and become something completely new over the centuries. Pull from whatever part of it you want. That's what makes this fun.
I think Fae will end up being a fantastic addition to a fantasy-type world. They're one of those monsters that are incredibly social. They have that whole culture to themselves, that they're doing their own thing. So it's easy to put a drop in. Your readers get an idea of, oh, the world is enormous, but they have enough of an idea to just sort of set that concept aside. But of course, writing elves are also a lot of fun. And that's what it comes down to, really, is having fun with it and
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Talent is cheaper than table salt. What separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work. Stephen King.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Sorry if my sound sounds a little bit off today. I am unable to make it to the studio to do recordings for the first little bit in January. But happy 2021.
Yay!
We are starting a new year. We've got a new theme for you this month. And this month we are covering the Pearls from the Masters.
Each episode we're going to be covering a different master of the craft and different advice that they give. So if you really like the openers of every episode we've done so far, this month is for you because it's a lot of that.
So a lot of people will always go to one book in particular if they're learning how to write. And that book is On Writing by Stephen King. So our first master that we're going to cover this month is Stephen King. He is very good at what he does. There's a reason why he basically defined an entire genre.
I think most people are at least familiar with his work in some regard.
If you aren't, you probably at least know of works like It, Pet Sematary, Carrie. Those were all from the creations of Stephen King.
So if you missed our last episode, last Thursday was December 31st. The frequently asked question that we covered was, how do I learn? And we offered some questions about how to analyze advice and feedback. That is going to be our format going forward through this month. And those questions are, do I agree with the advice being given? What evidence do I have that supports or defies that advice?
Do I share a target audience with the person giving the advice? And why am I getting this advice? Are they preaching to the choir, or does this challenge my status quo?
And how much do I value this person's opinion?
And the final question is, why have they given said advice before?
So our opener started with, talent is cheaper than table salt. Do you agree?
I don't know if I agree with that one. I think mostly what I see is underdeveloped writers. Yes, there are people with some natural talent in writing, but I've also seen quite a few with natural talent that do nothing with it. So I think I do get what he's saying here. Is if you have the talent and do nothing with it, it really doesn't matter, so it has the value of table salt.
And I think that kind of goes into the next quote. If you don't have time to read, you don't have the time or the tools to write. Simple as that.
This one is so important. I most definitely agree with this, and I know you do too, because you can't learn the instincts of writing without having read it.
This one I kind of feel like preaches to the choir a little bit, because people who don't read while they're writing aren't going to listen to this advice. I don't know of anybody who writes incredibly well that reads nothing.
Yeah, I agree with that. This one is definitely preaching to the choir, because if you aren't reading while you're trying to write, how much are you actually going to read advice in general?
Yeah, that's kind of true for all of the advice we're looking at.
So the next quote is, the road to hell is paved with adverbs. I know your opinion on this.
Yeah, it was about a year ago I very adamantly stated that I disagree with this one. I understand why it's said, but it's not actually adverbs that are the problem here. So yes, this challenges my status quo. No, I do not agree with it whatsoever.
But are you willing to listen to it and try to apply its intention to your writing, even if you like to still use adverbs?
Its intention is to eliminate redundancy, which I do strive for in my writing. So I will accept that one, yes.
And that little exercise right there is something that you, our listeners, can do as you're trying to improve writing. Even if you don't particularly like the advice, or if it challenges what you think is right, can you still pull something from it to help you improve or to see that you're on the right path as a writer? So our next quote is a bit of a long one, but stick with it, it's worth it. The most important things are the hardest to say. They are the things you get ashamed of because words diminish them. Words shrink things that seemed limitless when they were in your head to no more than living size when they're brought out. But it's more than that, isn't it? The most important things lie too close to wherever your secret heart is buried. Like landmarks to a treasure your enemies would love to steal away. And you may make revelations that cost you dearly, only to have people look at you in a funny way, not understanding what you've said at all. Or why you thought it was so important that you almost cried while you were saying it. That's the worst, I think, when the secret stays locked within, not for want of a teller, but for want of an understanding ear.
I think this really touches on a lot of authors' biggest fears. The pouring your heart into something, that writing selfishly, that emotional connection with your writing, and no one on the other side cares at all. If you're invested, that's when the great writing happens, and that's when it's most difficult to get on the page.
When I read through writing forums and writing groups, I have more than once come across somebody post wondering how they can get their significant other, their family, their friends to read and enjoy their books. And they all sound so heartbroken that no one close to them cares about what they're doing. It's hard, and like this quote says, it is scary, but the worst thing you can do is keep it locked away because you can't find someone close to you that will listen.
Someone out there needs to hear what you have to say, and they never will if you can't put it on the page.
Or sometimes it's just you that needs to put it down. Even if no one else reads it, that's what matters, is that you're doing it for you because you have that story that you need to get out.
On a little bit lighter note, this next quote is definitely one that I think more developed authors will totally cheer and raise their hands and agree with, but it's quite vexing to new authors, and they don't quite understand how this works. Description begins in the writer's imagination, but it should finish in the reader's.
I love this bit of advice. Personally, I agree with it. You can create this beautiful world, you can put the descriptions down on paper, but the readers will be the ones to visualize it.
I think as an author, this can challenge some people to not feed everything to your reader. I think that's what a lot of authors can take away from this particular quote, is you don't have to define the exact calendar system of this fantasy realm. You can leave some of that world building in your reader's imagination, and they will be that much more invested because of it. This next quote is definitely something that I've considered using for an opener, and we probably will again sometime soon when we talk about short stories. This quote is, "A short story is a different thing altogether. A short story is like a quick kiss in the dark from a stranger." I definitely agree with this one. So many people want to cram an entire novel into a short story and get the character's backstory in, make sure we understand the map and the this and the that. We don't have time for that. We just need a quick kiss in the dark.
This one challenges my status quo, personally. I understand the need to make it short, to make it quick, that I don't need all of the backstories there. But I also want to build big worlds in a short story. And that's something that I'm working on because I do know this advice is good and I need to apply it, but it's a challenge. Our next quote is, "Fiction is the truth inside the lie." What do you think of this quote?
I wonder if that's why we're all drawn to fiction in a way. If there's a truth, that internal discovery, that character's value that they learn to see in themselves, whatever it is that the characters are overcoming, we want to see it. And that truth is what gets you and your audience connected to each other.
Even if you are just writing a mystery novel, your fiction can tell the truth of humankind, of the good and the bad. And that's a lot of what fiction does, is shows us people, real people as they actually are, even though the characters are completely fictional.
Stephen King has a lot to say when it comes to the craft, when it comes to writing, but I do want to leave you with this last quote, which is, write with the door closed, rewrite with the door open, which of course basically means
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Readers tend to like a character who is at least superficially like themselves, but they quickly lose interest unless this particular character is somehow out of the ordinary. Orson Scott Card.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy December.
Yay.
We hope you had a good Thanksgiving and are looking forward to all of the festive holidays that are happening this month. As we do in December, we are doing a Frequently Asked Questions series. So we've taken your questions that you've submitted. We've taken questions that we see commonly when we are in writing forums and other places, questions that we get asked a lot, and trying to answer them here quickly and succinctly so that you know where to go, where to move forward. So what is today's question?
How descriptive are you with characters and landscape appearances? When do you describe them, and what about the sequel? Do you describe them then also?
So let's take this from the beginning. How descriptive do you get with character and landscape appearances?
My answer, as little as possible.
There are different approaches to the idea of describing characters, and it is somewhat genre-specific. But most experienced authors will agree on a couple of things. And one of those is you do not ever give a head-to-toe description just because.
Yeah, it's not often your character is going to stand in front of a mirror and notice the color of their own eyes.
No.
If anything, people tend to be self-critical. They're going to dislike something about themselves unless they're an incredibly vain character.
So it does depend on the character. That's the other thing experienced authors can agree on. It depends on the character, what they notice, and what they would describe. So, when do you describe characters? And this will go into how descriptive you get.
When I am describing any character, it's almost never from that character's point of view. He is noticing her across the room. She is checking somebody out.
It depends on the point of view, but you need to have a specific reason for describing the character in that moment. Think about the last time you met someone. How much about them did you notice? Did you really go full creeper and do a full body scan, taking note of every aspect of their body?
I really hope if you do this, there's some sort of comedic twist at the end. You're looking at her from the back and across the bar. You see the fantastic stiletto heels that perfectly match the short skirt and the long legs in between, the slender waist to get up to the front. The character turns around and full beard or something just completely off the wall. We're like, oh, okay, we're going on a different path here.
Again, that's a specific plot device to use there. Number one, your readers don't want to be overwhelmed with description. It gets boring. And number two, the more vague you are, especially with your main character, the more connected your reader can feel to them.
I would say most of the time, if I'm describing a character, that character is probably going to die in the length of the scene. This is mostly because I don't want to name guard one and guard two, so I'm going to say the fat one and the one with the stupid hair. They aren't going to last long.
not long enough for me to name them, but if they have two different bits of choreography, they need to be differentiated, therefore physical attributes are an easy way to do that.
So another time to describe that goes along with there's a specific reason is if there's something atypical about that character's body. Maybe they're missing an eye. Maybe they have severe scars on their face or some kind of disfigurement that stands out that will catch your main character's eye first.
Again, when your character is noticing something about themselves, it's rarely going to be a positive note because that's how a lot of people are, especially if your main character at the beginning of your story is going to believe a lie about themselves. I just had a scene where my character caught a glimpse of herself in a mirror, and she immediately turned away because she doesn't like what she sees.
When it comes to your main character's hair color, that kind of stuff, there needs to be a reason for it. So for my main character in my last book, because she likes to dye her hair, she has black hair with emerald highlights. There's a scene where she's kind of messing it up because she has a pixie cut, and she's trying to tease out those highlights to make them really stand out. So to sum up this of how and when to describe, think yourself. When you meet someone, when you're hanging out with someone, when is it that you notice something about their physical appearance? When is the last time that you met someone and immediately noticed their eye color? And do you really think in your head, oh, what delicious chocolate brown eyes those are? Honestly, no one notices brown eyes. Brown eyes are, sorry to say it, boring. They blend in most often.
If he has eyes like the sea after a storm, I don't quite know what that means, but it says something about her more than it does about him. He's got grayish blue eyes. Yay.
And that goes for a lot of your descriptions. It tells us more about the person describing them than the person being described. So if you are in a bar and watching for that really attractive person you want to hit on, and you give us a full-blown top-down description, I'm going to think you are a creeper that has stared entirely too long.
But if you're noticing height, skin color, tattoos, interesting markings, then you might be in law enforcement. You might not necessarily be there to pick somebody up at all.
You may be looking for someone to arrest.
And of course, if you're most of my characters, you are seeing somebody and their posture, where they sit, what kind of awareness they have of their surroundings, because you're assessing a threat level. You don't really care what color their skin is. You care if they watch when somebody comes in the front door.
So who is your character and what would they notice? That's how you decide when and how much to describe.
So what about a landscape?
A lot of the same principles apply here. It's when the characters would notice the landscape. If there is a new location, so they just arrived at this beautiful meadow covered with wildflowers, you can go a little bit into describing it.
One of the times when I am doing scene setting, it is intentional. I am mentioning intentional objects because then later when they pick up the vase and smash it into the bad guy's face, I don't need to describe the vase or where it is because I've already done that. A lot of my scene setting is for an upcoming fight.
That is when it's relevant to the story. The object or the thing that was described is going to be used. Remember Chekhov's gun. If you describe it, it needs to come into play somehow.
I always remember the Disney Renaissance animation style where you've got like Aladdin going into the genie's cave, and you've got piles of gold and this and that, and then one object in front that's traced differently.
And then you know exactly what's going to move because it's slightly brighter colors and more defined edges.
And fewer textures, you notice?
Yes, way fewer textures. And another time to describe a landscape is if there's world building to be done. In the Stormlight Archive series, there's quite a bit of landscape description because the world is different than ours. You have to describe that so your readers can get a good image of what's going on. But be careful. You can go too far.
Tolkien.
Don't go full Tolkien. Love his storytelling. His descriptions are too much. So, what about sequels? How do you describe things you've already described in a previous book?
There are two different kinds of sequels. We've talked about that before. One is an episodic where you can just pick out anyone, such as the Jack Reacher series, in which case he has basically one sentence that he uses in all of them, where he gives his height, weight, and hair color. But it's very brief, and we just sort of go with it for the rest of the time.
Even if it's serial, you go on the assumption that your readers have forgotten. They will need a reminder, but not an entire breakdown. Believe it or not, there are people out there in the world that read book 2 or 3 before they ever read book 1. So you do need something, but it doesn't have to be a full-blown description. Your readers can make something up in their mind without a description. Let them use their imaginations because it makes them more connected to the story.
You don't want to lose your fans from the original book because you're wasting their time in the second book.
You do, however, want to make specific mentions if something has changed between those books. So I mentioned earlier that my main character likes to dye her hair. So in the first book, she has black hair with green highlights, and in the book I'm writing now, she has slightly longer hair and it's purple. And I make a specific mention of that change, just so I make sure the readers don't look at that and go, wait, did I miss something? I thought there was something different earlier, different before.
Yeah, you don't want them to catch you in a continuity error because you're just changing things from book to book. Acknowledging the previous book or the previous state is a way to transition with a clean slate.
So overall, descriptions are good. They can really add to your story. But don't overwhelm your readers. Brief descriptions are good. 1 to 2 things at a time, because that's what we notice.
It all comes back to, is your reader enjoying the book? Are they feeling bogged down, or are they getting immersed in the details? That circles back to how you are writing it. If you don't remember, leave it out, move on. If you are writing because you think someone else thinks you need to have this in here, that's always dangerous, especially on your first draft. Because really, what you should be doing is
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call them at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
You could be writing The Book That Changes Your Life, Brandon Sanderson.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses. Today we are continuing our series on frequently asked questions by you, the listeners, and questions that we see recur often in forums worldwide.
Today's question is, what makes a book unforgettable? What makes a book impactful?
So much of this is subjective, and it comes down to understanding not only your audience, but yourself. What's going to impact you as the author, as our opener implied, but also understanding your audience. Because if the book is a romance, it will not impact me at all.
But you don't read romance for a reason. So know your audience is the first key, and know your genre. We'll be talking a little bit more about knowing your genre later this month, but let's get into how to make a book impactful. First off, think of your favorite book. Why is it your favorite? Is it the plot? Is it the style of writing? Or is it connection?
The book that comes to mind right now is my favorite because it entertained me in a way that I connected with. There was an emotional connection there between myself and the main character whom I have nothing in common with, but I felt that character and the problem that they were trying to overcome in a way that I internalized as a reader.
And that is the first key to making a book impactful. You have to have some kind of emotional connection with it. It doesn't have to be love. It doesn't have to be the romance side of it, but what does your audience connect with to create that emotion? The biggest thing is that you need to have a real character. Your characters need to be relatable. They feel real emotions, real struggles, things that even though we have nothing in common with them, they live in a completely different world, a completely different universe. We can still see that character and say, I understand them.
The book that comes to mind right now, the main character was basically wiped blank mentally, and they reinstalled a bunch of programming to make him the ultimate CIA agent. He still has this not only moral quandary about what's right and wrong outside of his programming, but this struggle for identity. And a lot of the problem is solved once he figures out who he is outside of his programming.
And the one thing you need to avoid when trying to create that emotional connection with the reader through your characters is perfection. Readers do not connect with perfection because it is unattainable. They can never see a perfect character and say, I know what that feels like because I am also perfect. Another way to make sure your book has impact is to know yourself, whether you are writing for art or whether you are writing for entertainment.
There is a lot of overlap in these two circles of art and entertainment, but the way I define it is art is something you as the audience invest in some way, and then entertainment is just everyone ingests it the same way. Everyone solves the puzzle the same way. Everyone watches the Marvel movie the same way. Art should be a connection to the audience. You understand that piece of art differently than I do.
I will read a book once for entertainment, and then I will read it again to appreciate it as art. Art is why I read Brandon Sanderson novels, because there's so much depth there that I can immerse myself into the world, the characters, the settings.
So art changes you on the other side.
Yes. So let's go on to the next way to make a book have impact. If you want your readers to feel impact from the book, they need to learn something. This applies to fiction as well as nonfiction. A lot of nonfiction is out there to teach a lesson specifically, tell you how to do something, give you instruction, self-help, whatever. Fiction, though, there are other ways to teach people something. In this process, for a reader to learn something, they need to learn something about themselves. They need to learn something about the other, they need to learn something about the world. You can do this by showing different point of views. Not actually right.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.